Okay, this is Gary Parrish again. It's the Ion College Basketball Podcast again, and I'm now talking to you on the morning of January 6th, otherwise known as the morning of the BCS National Championship game in college football between Florida State, that's number one, and number two, Auburn. Because it's Monday, my colleagues Matt Norlander and Jeff Borzello, they are here with me as usual. Fellas, do you have BCS picks? Who are you taking, Borzello, Florida State or Auburn?
I'm going Florida State, man. I think they're the most dominant team all year.
Breakdown Florida State.
Go ahead and break down the Seminoles for us.
I have nothing to break down. I just wish they would have played Alabama. Personally, I wanted to see them play Alabama, but I think they'll beat Auburn as well.
Give me Auburn. One because the way they've won, I guess I'm going to ride with that.
Luck, but luck. You're counting on some more luck tonight.
Why not? And then there'd be something, I don't know. I kind of root for the SEC and their honks to just go absolutely nuts, because this would mean, what, five straight years that Bama or Auburn won, and I guess eight in a row that an SEC team would have won the national title. So I'm totally cool with the BCS era ending with this streak of SEC teams before we go to the 14 playoff next year. What about you, GP?
I think Florida State's going to beat them by two touchdowns at least.
Yeah, because they've got 17, like it's you know, 17 future pros projected between the offense and defense. Yeah. I think a lot of
One article in like USA Today that said that they might be the best team ever if they blow out Auburn tonight.
They've blown out everybody, and here's what I think is happening. It's funny because if we have this conversation tomorrow, like we will speak definitively about Florida State one way or another. They'll either be one of the most dominant college football teams of all time, or at least in modern history, or they'll be just a team that beat up on a bunch of bad competition, and then when they had to face the SEC, they couldn't handle it, right? So tomorrow at this time, we're going to have very definitive opinions about Florida State.
Let's do a post-game podcast.
Let's do a post-game podcast late tonight. But what I think we're going to, like, I just think that if they play to the SEC or the Big 12 or some league other than the ACC, I think the spread would be bigger here. The other thing that I think people forget, not people, but like some people, Auburn shouldn't be here. You know, like, I mean, it quite literally should not be here. They got lucky against Georgia, and they got lucky against Alabama. And I don't mean lucky.
Destiny, man.
And I don't mean lucky. I don't believe in that stuff. I don't believe lucky in the sense that, wow, they won a game that they shouldn't have won. Like San Diego State might have got lucky at Kansas yesterday. I mean, they got quite literally got lucky, like fluky plays in the final minutes that led to them winning. So I don't think Auburn's really the second best team in the country. I think they're more like a bottom of the top 10 team in the country, and I think they're going to get run off the field. So bet if you have cash laying around, bet it all. If you can access cash, like cash out 401k plans or anything like that, bet it all on Florida State tonight. Either way, no matter what happens tonight.
What's the spread, 10.5?
Yeah, it's up to 10.5. It was at 8.
Oh, my gosh. I didn't realize it was that much.
Yeah, well, it was 8.5 like 2 days ago. I wish we would have had this podcast 2 days ago, so I could have told everybody to jump on it at 8.5. It's much better at 8.5 than 10.5, but I think they'll win by two.
What's your boy Chris Vernon, who couldn't stop bragging about his NFL picks over the weekend? Does he want those points? Is he taking all?
Yeah, he's taking the points. But keep in mind, he always brags about his wins, and then he has to pay his bookie like midweek every 3 weeks. So like he's your class. He's created this persona of how he's like some gambling aficionado, when in reality he's just the guy who brags about his wins.
Okay, gotcha. Yep. Yeah, it'd be like me bragging about picking Wake Forest to beat North Carolina, but I went 3-7. Guys, I am terrible at these.
Wake Forest one was that's a pretty good pick. We're gonna get to that in just a second. Here's what I was gonna say. I had a segue set up. You ready for it? Here it is. No matter what happens in tonight's college football national championship game, I bet you Jameis Winston and or Trey Mason will not end up benched in the final moments if the game is still in the balance, which means they will not get Jabari Parker. Norlander, I'll start with you.
Yeah.
What'd you make of Mike Krzyzewski sitting down, who is the leading candidate for National Player of the Year, in Saturday's loss at Notre Dame? What'd you make of that?
Yeah, this is maybe it's the biggest story coming out of the weekend. Duke losing at Notre Dame. It's their first true road game of the season, and Parker does not play down the stretch because his defensive issues. Basically, he was just embarrassed by Pat Connaughton. We've got the video and the GIF up on the blog if you want to take a look. A lot of sports happened this weekend, so if you missed it, it's definitely worth checking out. But that was basically what banished Parker to the bench. I don't agree with it. You know, we don't need to get into the whole, like, Mike Krzyzewski knows what he's doing. He's won 1,000 games.
I actually had to lead my post with a paragraph about that because you have no idea how many people are anxious to remind you that you're not a basketball coach. You know, like it's just, and so like I knew exactly what was going to happen when I was writing what I was going to write. So I like had to, I actually started the post with, he has 2 gold medals and 4 national titles and Mike Krzyzewski's a genius and blah, 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 blah. And yet still, when you start to post that way, you still get people going, well, you realize you're not a coach, Parrish. No, you know what, dumbass? I didn't realize I'm not a coach. I appreciate you pointing it out. Why? Forget it. I'm not going to go on Twitter.
Okay. So objectively, I would say, I guess subjectively from my point of view, I don't agree with it, but I don't know. He's not the only one. I mean, Rasheed Suleiman had like a freaking 3-week period.
Rasheed
this year.
Suleiman's not Jabari Parker.
Jabari Parker. I know. Can you let me finish here?
I don't know. Depends on if you're going to keep saying dumb things or not.
Are you going to be a Twitter user or what, GP?
If you'll stop saying dumb things like comparing Rasheed
Suleiman. I'm
speaking
within the relevance and context of Duke season and how Krzyzewski has shown this pattern of behavior before, but Parker is obviously not Suleiman. Okay. So ultimately, I don't know if it's going to benefit him down the road or not, but Krzyzewski has his ways. I would not have done it. To me, it doesn't make too much sense, but I don't think it's going to greatly alter Duke's season one way or the other.
I think that's fair. Let me ask you, Norlander, first, and then Borzello. Can you remember, because I guess when you write something like what I wrote Saturday, which is, hey, listen, I don't get this. Is that something I would ever do? The reactions are typically, they fall in one of two categories. Either, A, people just want to remind you you're not a coach and Mike Krzyzewski knows more than you know and whatever, or people agree with you, right? But here's what I found interesting. Can you name any other player of Jabari's caliber, any other player like that in any sport, professional or college, who, when's the last time you can remember somebody like that being benched in the final 4 minutes of a close game?
At his level, I mean, I can't. I would have, like, if I had to take a guess, like, Izzo might have done something where he had a good player that maybe in the past 10 years, but I can't. Doesn't mean it hasn't happened, but there's nothing that sticks out. And this does seem like if for some reason Duke goes on like a 9-game winning streak now, like, everyone's going to point to this being as the reason or something happened. But
right.
And that's not, nah, that kind of stuff is just so easy to point to and so rarely is the actual reason. But no, I can't remember specifically something like this happening. It is pretty notable. Like, I would have never thought this to be possible, I guess, for Parker to kind of find the doghouse like that. But and maybe in a small way, it is good for him. But again, I just don't know how much true grand impact it'll have on Duke's season. And by the way, real quick before Borzello hops in, you know, Duke, I still think, is a really talented team that has a very good, like, I would still take them to make the Final Four. But they've been tripped up a few times here now. I mean, this is 3 losses overall. And their best win is against Michigan, I guess, maybe UCLA, either one. So they look good, but they're not as good as I thought they'd be to this point.
Borzello, can you remember, and I don't mean like a good, like, you know, like, I get your point, like, Izzo might have set down a good, I got that. I'm talking about, this is the leading candidate for National Player of the Year, right, and perhaps the number one pick in the NBA draft. I can't remember a guy like, I mean, at the NBA level, and again, I'm not comparing to these guys, but he is these guys at the college level. It would be like Oklahoma City, you know, down 6 with 4 minutes to go, and Scottie Brooks benching Kevin Durant because he just gave up a dunk. Or you know, the Heat down 6 to, you know, whoever, and LeBron James on the bench. Like, that just does, like, it really, like, and this is why I wrote what I wrote. It doesn't happen. That never happens in basketball at any level. And the idea that it happened on Saturday, I thought was, I mean, you can say at the end of the road it's a teaching moment and it's not going to matter much, and maybe that's all true, but it is very rare to, like, we can argue about how big of a deal it is, I guess. And I recognize neither one of you are arguing with me, but it's extremely rare to witness something like that.
And especially, I mean, it's not like Duke had five guys on the court that were all making shots. And that, you know, like they had Rodney Hood and Quinn Cook were the only two guys scoring. And I know Parker had a bad game. I think he was 2-for-10 or 2-for-9 or something like that. But it just doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, they needed baskets. They needed a three-pointer. And even if Parker's – even if you don't give him the ball, just having him on the court, Notre Dame has to guard him. I think it would open up more shots for somebody else if that's what, you know, Coach K wanted to do. But just to have him on the bench after a bad game – I mean, I guess it could be a teaching moment, but to me, it could also bring his confidence down. You know, maybe in the back of his mind, he's thinking, all right, well, if I have another bad game, am I going to be taken out again? So I guess it could go both ways. I mean, most people would say it'll motivate him or turn him around or whatever, but, you know, he's a freshman. Maybe his confidence level takes a dip after that.
Yeah, I just, I got a lot of responses. People saying, well, you know, it'll teach him. Like, what will it teach him exactly? Right. Like that,
that
he needs,
he's going to have to go on the bench?
that he needs to make more shots? You know, like, I'm sure he knows that. I don't think he needs to learn that. Clearly, the kid was off, right? But how many times have we seen players, particularly in college basketball, you know, great players, and not all players are created, you know, great equally, but guys who are high-level college basketball players struggle for 35 minutes and then be the reason that their team won the game. What was in the Villanova Kansas game early this year in the Bahamas?
Yeah, Arch. Yeah.
Wasn't he struggling all game and then hit the game winner?
Arch. Yeah, Arch Diacono with Villanova. Decker to a minor point Sunday night in that Iowa game, which I know we'll get to. He was really quiet. Then he hit a really big shot. So that happens often.
Sure.
Don't you think it was as much as
defense,
his offense?
Yeah,
though?
That's what everyone seemed to say was his defense. Yeah, he's not guarding anybody. Yeah.
I get that, but like,
they needed baskets.
I guess my thing would be this. I would never care. You know, there is no scenario under which I would ever bench my best player, who also doubles as arguably the best player in the country, for the final 4 minutes of a close game on the road. I just would not. He could be 0-15 and just giving up two straight dunks. And if I got to try to win a game, I'm going to have the guy who's going to be the number one pick in the draft on the court, right?
I'm trying to picture Gary Parrish, Division I college basketball coach right now.
Coach Jabari Parker.
Like,
coach
running Hull. Practices, dealing with post-game in the meet. First of all, you'd be the best coach ever to deal with. But I'm just wondering how you'd actually, like, operate your team, how you'd recruit. Would you only, like, play six guys?
Oh, I would, yes, I would play Old seven guys. Coach. We'd probably cheat. I mean, I would be buying players. Like, I ain't trying to lose. Like, given the fact that I've always thought this, I'm not advocating cheating, but, and here goes an entirely podcast is going another direction now. I'm not advocating cheating, but given how hard it is to get caught, I mean, you gotta try to get caught. You have to really do something stupid to get caught, or have somebody who you trust completely rat you out, and then even then you might not get caught. Given the odds of you getting caught, when you compare that to the salary that you're able to make by being successful, which is $1.5-2-3 million a year, I think the reward far outweighs the risk. Any coach who is struggling on the so-called hot seat, given that your options are start winning and keep making $2 million a year, or keep losing and get fired and go back to being an assistant making $200,000 a year, I don't know why they all don't cheat. Like, I'm being dead. I'm not even joking. I would buy, yeah. I think I'd get a job, and then I would, or how about this, like a mid-major coach? If you're a mid-major coach, you get a job, you're making $750,000 or $500,000, whatever it is. And you know that all you got to do is get two good players, win your league, go to the tournament, win a game, and then you can go get a Big Ten job for $2 million a year. Why would you not cheat? Why would you not go buy players to make that happen? It is, again, probably won't get caught. And if it works, you've just turned a $500,000 a year job into a $2 million a year job. Why would you not do it? I mean, besides all, you know, your moral compass and
all
that crap.
Yeah, basically, that's...
Well, yeah, I guess that's what holds people back is their
morals. That's what
it
comes down to.
Yeah, no, yeah. I got all that, right? I'm just saying, like, in terms
from
of...
From a practical standpoint,
from a practical standpoint, it makes a lot... Particularly, like, if... Yeah, I guess you'd probably start out... I'd probably start out saying, I'll do this the right... I'm going to do it the right way, whatever the hell that means. And
all right, let's stop lying.
Well, everyone wants to think they can win games the right way. Sure. Bending the rules,
right? But then after about 2 years of losing, I'd be like, "All right, we about to go buy somebody."
All right, so real brief, and we don't have to stay on this, but just so listeners have an idea, because I feel like if I was listening and wasn't attached to the business, I would the question that would pop up is, okay, so these guys cover college basketball. They talk about how rampant cheating can be and how guys can and will do it. Do either one of you kind of want to explain how the challenge that comes with us and reporting and actually kind of get it, like, if we talk about how cheating is out there so much, mm-hmm. then why don't we break more stories about it? Can you kind of explain to listeners that might not realize what that actually entails and how tough it actually is?
I would say that is very hard to, like, when I'm sitting here saying it's very hard to get caught, I mean it's very hard to get caught, period. By I don't mean just the NCAA, by reporters. I mean, like, if you're smart about it, first off, there's a lot of legal ways to cheat, you know, to entice people to join your program, from donating to nonprofits to, you know, so on, you know, getting girlfriends, academic scholarships at your university, like all this type of stuff goes on. Beyond that, if you're just dealing in straight cash, like, how are you going to get caught? You have to have somebody rat on you, basically, to get caught,
or leave a really obvious paper trail, and nobody's doing that.
I'm not saying nobody's doing it, but you got to be stupid to do it. Like, if there's a lengthy paper trail, you're being dumb about it.
It's not 1987 anymore. Like, there's just no excuse.
There's
right.
Guys are more sophisticated about it. Listen, I didn't bring any of this up to brag about my past, but I broke one of the biggest recruiting scandals in the history of the NCAA when I was a 23-year-old prep writer. At a newspaper, it involved the number one defensive lineman in the country going to Alabama for $150,000 cash. And the only reason I was able to break that story wasn't because I heard whispers, because everybody had heard whispers. It was because one of the high school assistant coaches, the way that was supposed to go down is the high school coach set up a deal with a big-time Alabama booster who lived in Memphis named Logan Young. And the deal and his assistant coach was like his confidant, like his sidekick, the guy who helped him come up, develop this plan. Well, they were supposed to get $150,000 and then they were supposed to split the money, except the head coach kept all the money. So the assistant coach got pissed off and he told me about it. So essentially what it took for me to ever get that story, I'd like to tell you like I was some young, brilliant investigative sports reporter, but that's not really the truth. What happened is the guy who was in on the deal and knew the ins and outs of the deal didn't get his share of the deal. And so he was like, oh, if you're not going to take care of me, then I'm going to rat you out. Now, even then, for him to rat him out, it became a federal crime, like the U.S. Attorney's Office got involved. They ended up charging all of these guys, the booster, the head coach, and the assistant coach with felonies. And the assistant coach, who was essentially a whistleblower for my purposes, ended up becoming charged with a felony, had to plead guilty to that felony, and lost his job in Memphis City Schools. And so he had to sacrifice his own career to be able to bring down that kind of to bring to light that kind of recruiting story. And so how many people are willing to do that? Not many. Again, it's just we can't report whispers. We can't report what we think might have gone down. We have to essentially have somebody – we have to have a paper trail, which is very difficult to find these days because the smart guys are more sophisticated about how they're doing things. Or you got to have somebody on the inside willing to talk, and there's almost never an incentive – for right. somebody on the inside to talk. So these stories, like after I got that story, you know, I'm like 23 years old and I'd go on radio interviews and people would say, so when are you going to get the next one? Well, like probably never. Like that's probably as good as it gets. And, I was getting all sorts of tips and I was chasing things down, but still those things are so difficult to prove. And it's why honestly, some of the guys like Charles Robinson who those guys who have really done some nice work, Dan Wetzel and Adrian Wojnarowski, were able to get a paper trail connected to the UConn program. They still exist. I'm not trying to pretend they don't, but they're very, very, very rare.
Okay. All right. Good. I just figured it would be good to sometimes
Oh, yeah. No, you're exactly.
We'll get the tweets like, you guys know about this. Why don't you do some reporting? Like, I think a lot of people do understand, but plenty don't really realize the internal, like Borzello specifically, like just because of what he does and how well he's tied into the recruiting circuit, like he could give you 25 rumors off the top of his head
like,
about
it's like but, when I come back from like a summer like on the recruiting trail, like I'm like telling my friends stories and stuff like that. They're like, oh, well, why don't you report it? I'm like, because I don't know, it's like it's a rumor. Like I can't just go out there and just give this innuendo that so-and-so is cheating and so-and-so did this and so-and-so did that.
Right. No, so. I could tell you a story about a prominent college basketball program having a booster make a $50,000 donation to a YMCA in a particular city to help get a player to commit to a program. Like, I believe that happened. I could tell you a story about a shoe company, you know, funding a summer basketball program way over and above what it typically costs to run a summer basketball program to get a prospect to go to a certain school. I mean, all of these stories exist, you know, but they're very difficult to prove. You know, I can't get my hands on shoe company contracts. I've tried, you know, but you can't get them unless somebody inside leaks them to you. So let's say that there was a prominent – here's a perfect example. I believe this to be true. Prominent shoe company funds a summer basketball program at you know, five times as much as what it costs to typically run a summer basketball program. A kid, somebody close to a high-profile prospect runs that summer basketball program. That money is at their disposal. They could do whatever they want to with it. Sure, they got to buy hotels and flights and all that stuff for a summer basketball program. But after that, you know, there's maybe $100,000, $150,000 left over. Yeah. Now, you could do whatever you want to with that money. Now, the only way and first off, it's not really illegal or in violation of NCAA rules, because the NCAA is never going to get involved in telling what shoe company, whether it's Nike, Adidas, Under Armour, what it is they can and cannot do with their money, because the NCAA needs and the universities need Nike's money and Adidas' money and Under Armour's money and so on and so forth. So the NCAA would never walk down this path anyway. But okay, so how could I prove that what I just described actually happened? I'd need to get my hands on a shoe company contract. Now, what incentive is there for anybody at that shoe company to leak me that contract? I've tried to get it. I mean, I'm talking about a very specific case. You guys probably know who I'm talking about. I've tried to get my hands on that shoe. But the guy, if there was somebody who would leak me that contract, that guy would get fired. You know, he would lose his job. So is it worth somebody at one of these shoe companies risking their own profession, their own career, their own livelihood to get some story out in the open about something they probably don't think's that wrong anyway? No, probably not. And so here we are, right?
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. So it speaks to when we do have stories like this that are able to break and we have investigative stories. It speaks to reporting, but it also talks on the side of the NCAA, who's often lampooned, sometimes rightly and sometimes just because it's easy to pile on, just how tough it is for them to do their jobs.
They have hard jobs.
As seen as, you know, nerdy hall monitors, and obviously everyone's going to try and dodge and deflect them.
That's so. The most interesting thing about it all now is the tone with all of this stuff has changed. In other words, once upon a time, if you could break – like, let's just say the Oklahoma State story, football story that Sports Illustrated did. Mm-hmm. Once upon a time, like, you know, 10 years ago even, if you'd have wrote that story, it would have been like, kids are getting free meals and smoking pot.
Absolutely.
It would have been oh, my God. Yeah. And now it's like the nation, like, people do not care.
Right. Like totally. I 100% agree on that. Like, 10 years ago and 20 years ago, it probably would have been seen as like this, like, beacon of really good journalism, whereas now I just think everyone's a little just more savvy and hip to the game. Like, it's just not as sensationalistic as I tried to sell it as, and so it totally, in my opinion, it just totally fell flat.
Right. Anyway, let's get back to basketball. We talked a little bit about Duke losing at Notre Dame. They weren't actually the only ranked team to lose to an unranked team this week. And Oklahoma State lost to Kansas State. Connecticut lost at SMU. Memphis lost at home to Cincinnati. Carolina, as Norlander predicted, lost at Wake Forest. And then in terms of point spreads, it wasn't a unranked team and a ranked team, but two ranked teams. But in terms of point spreads, the biggest upset of the high-profile games was actually Kansas losing at home to San Diego State. Of those games, Borzello, what was the most surprising to you?
I guess I would probably say Wake Forest beating North Carolina. And I know we shouldn't be surprised by North Carolina losing to anyone anymore.
Right.
But I kind of thought they had gotten over that whole inconsistency thing. And apparently they haven't. So to me, I think that was the most surprising one. I was most impressed of any of the winning teams. I was most impressed with San Diego State because I think they're legitimately the best team in the Mountain West, and I think they could be, you know, a really tough out in March just because they have so much size and length inside it. And it was supposed to be a rebuilding year for them. They lost Jamal Franklin, they lost Chase Tapley, but you know, Steve Fisher, he reloaded quicker than we thought. And you know, it's a down year for the Mountain West, but San Diego State should be the best team in that league by a little bit of a margin.
I think the Wake one wasn't terribly surprising.
Yeah, I wasn't that surprised by that.
Because of what Carolina showed, Wake is better. I by no means do I think Wake is going to make the tournament, but they are 11-3. It's their best start ever under Bezdelic. They had kind of kept it interesting against Kansas in the past. They beat Richmond and OT, a decent team. But Carolina is by far their best win. And I just continue, like, I'm rooting for Carolina to do this all season long, just because I think it's interesting.
Well, they
like,
probably are.
Get them in that 8-9 game, have them win the first one, and then just totally muck things up. Yeah, the San Diego State one did surprise me the most. I didn't think Kansas would, first of all, I didn't think Kansas would have four losses. Their schedule is obviously one of the toughest in the country, and they have four really good losses. But for San Diego State to do that, and the way they did it, to anyone that was able, and obviously the football games were taking up so much of the national sports conversation, but I hope most people listening to this podcast, and if you would, you'd be a College Hoops fan enough to know to watch that game. The way that the Aztecs were just eating up the offensive glass was, I just can't remember a Bill Self team that was beat out in the paint like that before. I'm sure it's happened, but I just couldn't remember it in recent history, the way that the Aztecs were able to do that. And yet, Kansas didn't play well at all, like at all. Only lost by four. Granted, they have all of that talent. They were at home. I think that was the biggest surprise. I think, and Parrish, you can obviously speak to this because you wrote the column on it, but this is going to get totally overlooked in pretty much every area except where you live in Cincinnati. But for Cincinnati to go into Memphis in the first conference game and like just totally punk the Tigers, that was an early Saturday game. Obviously, we've had so much happen since then, so it's so easy to completely overlook it. But that was pretty notable for both teams on that end.
It's one thing to lose, right? Memphis was only like a 5-point favorite in that game. And so you're talking about a 2-possession game, even if it goes the way oddsmakers suspect it should go. But, you know, to have 18,000 fans in your home arena for your first league game in a real league in a long time, and not just lose, but get like pumped. I mean, that's a good way to describe it. I mean, I sat there and watched it. I mean, They were awful. Memphis was awful. And Cincinnati was good. I think Cincinnati's better than we probably thought, right? Yeah. I mean, Cincinnati's like...
I think the fact that they play ugly kind of...
Right. And I talked to them about that, the you know, Mick about that the other day, and Justin Jackson and Sean Kilpatrick. And they said, listen, we know who we are. You know, like, we'd like to score 80 points a game, but we don't need to do that. And I do think this is interesting, and I need to go look at the actual numbers because they are available. But Mick Cronin being the head coach of Cincinnati, his point is, like, listen, we and this is true at least against Memphis. They were trying to run. Cincinnati was trying to run. He's like, listen, we're not just dribbling the air out of the ball and running the shot clock down to five. The reason that that obviously they're not very good offensively, but that's also part of the reason they run, because they don't want to try to score, you know, playing 5-on-5. Mm. But he said, the reason that our games can be low scoring is because we guard, like, we are really good defensively, and it's not easy to get a shot against us. So we're going to try to stop you in transition, which is what they did against Memphis, and then make you try to get a shot against us in the half court. And that's going to take you a little bit of time. And when that, you know, then you look up and there's, you know, 3 minutes are gone, 7 minutes are gone. Now it's halftime. And he said, so if we could score 80, we'd love to, but we're comfortable. If we need to beat you in the 50s, or even as they showed against Pittsburgh in the 40s, we'll do it. And I guess I've always been a fan of teams that truly have an identity and seem comfortable with it. And this Cincinnati team, I guess this is what I came away with the other day. Like, they have an identity. They know who they are, and they seem to embrace it. And now they're sitting here. I've got them ranked. I don't know if they'll be in the AP top 25 today, but they're ranked, you know, at the top 25-1 right now. And I think they're top 20 at KenPom right now. I don't want to say a great basketball team, because I don't think they are great, but they're a hell of a tough out. Like, they're going to be tough for people to beat with the way they're playing right now.
defense is good enough to warrant them being top 25, in my opinion. Have a win over Pittsburgh, beat Memphis. Their two losses are to New Mexico and Xavier, two teams I think will make the NCAA tournament. So I think that's worthy. And Cronin, by the way, I mean, he's been knocked in the past, rightfully so, for a weak non-conference schedule. Has that again this year. For the most part, that Pittsburgh is really the only one outside of league play. As weird as it is to hear, Pittsburgh and Cincinnati are no longer conference foes.
Right.
But, yeah, and the American will be interesting just because we'll see what Louisville is without Bohannon. UConn, I mean, you want to talk about that for a second? I mean, UConn.
Yeah, I think.
UConn has three losses, guys, okay? Stanford, not that good.
No.
And then they go down to Texas and just completely. I mean, the SMU, and by the way, like, I do want to give credit to Larry Brown for, to this point, being pretty good overall. But UConn drops to Houston. And it wasn't even, like, pretty, apparently, on New Year's Eve. I'll admit, I didn't watch the game, but I was told they did not look good. And then they lose to SMU. And so now the Huskies, they don't have a lot inside, and they're probably still going to make the tournament, but their best wins, guys. Maryland start the season. Indiana, who doesn't have one win over a tournament team. And they beat Florida thanks to Scotty. Well, I was there. Yes. Scotty Wilbekin went out with an ankle injury. And Shabazz, that was luck. Like, GP, that was luck.
Oh, no.
It was a tipped, deflected play off DeAndre Daniels' hands when he tried to put it back in at the buzzer, and Napier got a second chance at a buzzer beater. So I think the jury can very much still be out on UConn.
I think Connecticut is the classic team, and this happens all the time, right? You look at a resume at a certain point, and you go, oh, wow, that looks good. And then you look at that exact same resume 2 weeks later, and you go, okay, this isn't nearly as good as we thought it was at that time. You know, you start with the win over Maryland. At a season opening win over Maryland. Now, I don't think anybody expected Maryland to be great, but I don't think anybody expected Maryland to be this bad. All right? So you go, okay, that's a nice win. Maryland sounds good, if nothing else. And again, on November 8th, we didn't know what Maryland was going to be. Then you knock out Indiana on a neutral by a point. You go, okay, listen, Indiana, that's top 25-ish team. You know, you go ahead and win that on a neutral court. That's a nice one. Then you beat Florida, and yeah, Scotty Wilbekin went down, but you know, you sort of, at least I am, of the mindset of wins a win's a win. So you get that one. Now you're undefeated, 8-0, with wins over Maryland, Indiana, and Florida. Hey, that's a top 10 resume. And I do think it was at the time. But then you see the loss to Stanford, losses to Houston and SMU, and then you start to go back and look at those exact same wins. Maryland's not good at all. Indiana, you know, just got ran off the court at home by Michigan State. Now, Michigan State's really good, but still, Indiana hasn't proved to be anything of note. They're 0-2 in the Big Ten right now. And then the win over Florida. Florida lost a very important player, and still, you needed a lucky shot to beat them by a point at home. I think UConn is settling into what they really are, which is, you know, probably maybe a borderline NCAA tournament team, top 35, 40 team in the country. Is that fair?
Yeah, boys, I'll let you chime in here, but that Harvard game.
I think they're an NCAA tournament team, but they're one of those good. I mean, a good team should be able to win, you know, in multiple ways. But they have basically, if they're not hitting 3-point shots, they're not winning games, and it's sort of like almost like a mid-major way to win games. Nothing against that, but like they don't have any inside play. Shabazz Napier, he struggled, and when that if Napier struggles, they don't win games. They're very dependent on him being good. And, you know, in the AAC, there's Cincinnati, SMU. Those teams are big physical defense. And, you know, it's going to be hard for Napier and the small UConn guards to really get going. And, you know, they have the Harvard game coming up this week. And that would be, what, their second best win if they beat Harvard?
Maybe. Yeah,
Florida. Yeah. Florida's the best, right? Harvard would, you know, according to Kenpom, if they win,
I think Harvard is probably a better team.
That's going to be a coin flip game, like in terms of a point spread. They'll be favored by two or three, but like it ain't going to be much.
Like Harvard might be a better team, and I think for Harvard, this is like their, you know, they haven't really played many teams, many good teams, so they're going to get up for this game, and because this would be sort of their marquee win for the entire season.
It's a big stretch, yeah. I mean, it's a big stretch for UConn in general. All right, they got Harvard, and then they get UCF at home on Saturday. Should win that, but then
Memphis and Louisville after that, right?
Yep, exactly. Yep. So those are the next four. They could
be 1-3.
They could go 1-3 in that stretch and be 1-5 overall. And not that it will happen, but if it did happen, they would be clearly outside the NCAA tournament picture if they lost this.
Before we move on, I do want to go back to that San Diego State-Kansas game just a little bit, and for two reasons. I think tomorrow we're going to do some midseason awards after the BCS National Championship game is over, because that is when a lot of people – I think there's two points where people start to focus more on college basketball than they did the week prior. And one of them is after the college football national championship game, and the other is after the Super Bowl. It, just in terms of my, and I'm sure this is the case with you guys as well, media requests, in terms of radio interviews, they shoot up once there's no longer college football to talk about, once there's no longer the NFL to talk about. But I do think, for all the reasons that Borzello pointed out earlier, like, Steve Fisher would probably be my midseason coach of the year. Like, this is not supposed to be a good team at all. And yet, they're sitting here with some really good wins, only lost to number one Arizona. The job San Diego State is doing, the job Steve's doing there. First off, the job Steve's doing there in general is off the charts. But the job he's doing this year is another level as well. And then, you know, they handed Kansas in Allen Fieldhouse the fourth loss of the season. Some people are freaked out about Kansas. I still don't mind them much. I get it. I'd rather them not be 9-4 coming off a loss at home to San Diego State. But the four losses are to four teams I have ranked in the top 11 or the top 25 and one. There's still, I think, Kansas is like 13 or 14th at KenPom, top 20 offense, top 20 defense. I don't think there's any doubt they're the best, quote, four-loss team in the country, whatever that means. But should we be panicking about Kansas? Like, if you had to, you know, maybe – I guess in the preseason, if you had to pick a Final Four, I would have had Kansas in mind. Should Kansas still be in there?
Borzello?
I mean, I still don't trust their point guard play. Nadir Tharpe and Frank Mason, they look really good sometimes. You know, like against Georgetown, Nadir Tharpe looked great. And then yesterday, they turned it over at key times. And, you know, they couldn't get their big men the ball. Perry Ellis couldn't do anything. Wiggins, you know, he was in and out. But to me, I mean, it comes down to their ability to initiate half-court offense, and they couldn't do it yesterday. And some of that obviously is credit to San Diego State just because of how they guarded the rim and played inside, and Kansas couldn't make shots. But, I mean, I don't know if I trust Tharpe and Mason to be, you know, point guards on a Final Four team.
Would you pick them, Norlander, to even win the Big 12 right now?
I was going to say that. Who's the best team in the Big 12?
Mm-hmm. I'd still pick them. I'm just going to pick them.
Take them. Yeah, I still am going to take them because this wasn't a Big 12 game. I just can't bet against Bill Self to win the Big 12.
It always comes back to that. Like, he doesn't lose the Big 12.
God, it's crazy. And the Big 12 is a really good league. Just one quick aside here. Are we going to update our Player of the Year watch Wednesday? I would say we should probably be fair here. I would not put Wiggins top 15 right now. I think he's been good, but I think his production ultimately has dropped just out of that. I think it pains us to kind of admit to that.
I'm not admitting to it. You can if you want to.
You still think he should be top 15?
I would have to look at it. I mean, I get, like, people, it's funny, like, every you know, particularly when you get to a point where you're updating the top 25 and one every day, after every result comes in, it's like, where are you going to rank this team? Where are you going to rank that team? And my answer is always, I'll have to look at it, you know? So I honestly haven't looked at it. I'll look at it probably tomorrow night for the first time. But, you know, still, again, at least according to my college basketball rankings, he's still the leading scorer on a top 20 team in the country.
He dropped to fourth in my freshman ranking behind Tyler Ennis, and I think the gap between like him and Aaron Gordon and you know the 6, 7, 8 guys is smaller than the gap between him and Tyler Ennis in terms of freshman rankings.
I tend to, like, if you want to admit one of my faults, I can be stubborn in this way. Like, I remember, I guess it was several years ago now, but I had John Wall preseason National Player of the Year, and John Wall was terrific, right? But I held on to it forever. Like, no, he should be Player of the Year. And like Evan Turner was having this crazy great year, right? And I think I waited till like February before I moved off John Wall. I was like, I'm just gonna hang on to this. I was just trying to hang on. And so I'll do the thing with Wiggins. Like, listen, there's no denying that he's not the National Player of the Year right now, right? But to me, that argument was always, you know, like, if you were arguing against it, like, you'll get a lot of people who will say, oh, you were wrong about Andrew Wiggins. Well, like, really, how wrong was I? I said he'd be great, and he is. He's really good. He's still projected to be the number one pick in the draft. He might not be the best player in college basketball right now. I can acknowledge that. But, like, you know, who is? Like, let's call it Jabari Parker. Well, guess what? Everybody was wrong about Jabari Parker then. Like, everybody. Because nobody had – who had Jabari Parker as a preseason National Player of the Year?
I don't think anyone.
Nobody.
I know we're going to have to talk about Wiggins way down the road too. So I don't want to spend 5 minutes on Wiggins. But my only thing here with Wiggins is, and I still very much like him. I get the feeling that whether you want to say fans media, whoever you want to say is that nebulous group, they were sold a bill of goods on Wiggins, and he hasn't been ridiculously awesome.
I agree with that.
And so there's this natural letdown. So I just know like football's going to end, and I just know it's coming. The Wiggins topic is just going to come, so we don't have to spend time on this. I know we're going to talk about it on future podcasts.
No, whatever. We don't have a time limit. I'm perfectly happy to talk about it. there is no denying he hasn't been this overwhelming Kevin Durant presence, you know, but I never thought he was going to be. If you go back and read the preseason story I did on him, I projected that he would average right around 15 points a game. That's what I thought he would be, you know, and I also said that, you know, by the end of the year, it'll be clear that he's the best player in college basketball. Not just the projected number one pick in the NBA draft, but the best player in college basketball. Now, if you were to ask me again right now, do I think that part's going to be true? I'm not sure that by the end of the year, he's going to be widely considered or even considered at all to be the best player in college basketball. All right, I can acknowledge that right now. But he is averaging 15.8 points and 5.4 rebounds per game. He's leading Kansas in scoring. Kansas is still a top 20 team as far as I'm concerned. So I just refuse to label him as some massive disappointment. He is a disappointment relative to he's going to be preseason National Player of the Year. I got that, right? But you know what he is? Like in this world of 24/7 evaluation, he's 3 23-point games away from being considered that again. Like it could happen. Like next Saturday, is it next Saturday? No, it's a week from this coming up Saturday. He's got Oklahoma State on national television, and then on Big Monday, 2 days later, he's got Baylor on national television. Let him go wild in one of those games and be really good in the other one, and we'll be right back where we were talking about Andrew Wiggins as a national player. So this stuff could change pretty quickly, particularly with an 18-year-old, you know, who could turn it on in late January and February, as guys in the past have done. But listen, I can acknowledge that he hasn't been as consistently awesome as I thought he'd be, or honestly, once I made the opinion, as that I hoped he would be. Let me ask you this then: who should be? Because I was thinking about this earlier today. Who should be atop that player of the year list right now?
Didn't Borzell and I both pick Parker as preseason player of the year? I know I did.
I picked him freshman of the year. I didn't pick him player of the year.
National player of the year?
I'm almost positive I picked him national player of the year.
I would need you to prove that to me.
All right, I'm gonna Google this right now. But I would say I would have Parker. I would still have Parker right now, given all that he's done. But it's getting really interesting.
Why not?
Top.
Let me ask you this: why not Doug McDermott?
Yeah, I know. And hey, I'm willing to be convinced. Absolutely.
I think I'm on the Doug McDermott thing right now because, like I get it. He's not the pro prospect that Jabari is. Although I think he's a lottery pick. I think Doug McDermott can be a lottery pick. I mean, I think he's
going to find a way to make shots in the NBA.
I live in Memphis, where the Grizzlies ain't got a single dude who can make a shot outside of Mike Miller. Like, outside of Mike Miller, who's older than I am.
Every team needs a shooter.
It's not even debatable to me. Once upon a time, it was debatable about whether Doug McDermott would play in the NBA. That is not even debatable to me anymore. Doug McDermott's going to be in the NBA. I'm just wondering if he can't be a top 10 pick, top 15 pick. I love him. I don't mean just love him as a college player. I don't want to say I love him as a pro prospect, but I give me 15 picks. I'd probably take him in one of those. But the guy's just off the charts, like performing at a high level consistently. He doesn't really have those off games, you know. I mean, he's had one or two this year, but he's doing everything that I'd like to see from a National Player of the Year candidate do, which is A, have ridiculous statistics, which he does now really for the third straight year. He's leading a program to something that is unusual for that particular program, historically speaking. He's leading a team to places that there's no way on earth it would be without him. I mean, they're not ranked in the top 25 right now, but I think they will be in the AP top 25 later on this afternoon. Either way, they're top 10 at KenPom right now, which suggests they're better than what most pollsters realize or anybody realizes. And though with the Big East schedule, they haven't played, you know, maybe a Villanova yet or a Georgetown yet or a St. John's yet or whatever. But they have played Marquette and they played Seton Hall, and those are two quote, power conference schools, at least historically speaking, and he worked both of them pretty easily. And so, listen, we'll talk about it before we update the rankings on Wednesday. Certainly you can make a case for Jabari Parker, but I think I'm leaning toward Doug McDermott right now.
I mean, I can see that. He's just putting up ridiculous numbers. Like, you know, I think the only person, I think the Creighton media relations department passes along that the only player in the past 15 years to average 24-7 and shoot 42% from three was Kevin Durant.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, so that's like the last guy to put up numbers like that. Like, every night he's putting up 30 and 10. Like, he had 30, 10, and 5 on Saturday. And, like, I didn't want to put him in the players with impact in night court because, like, it just seems like it's a regular night for him.
That's the problem.
And,
like,
that's crazy to think about.
Honestly, I think, unless you guys have another suggestion, I think he's going to be the CBSSports.com player of the week.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think he's the right pick. But by the way, I think he's going to be the first three-time All-American since Hansbrough. I think that's going to be the case.
I think they said that first three-time first-team All-American since Wayman Tisdale.
Why? No, so Hansbrough didn't win it. Wow.
I thought Hansbrough was.
I thought Hansbrough was too.
Yeah. I would have definitely thought Hansbrough would have been a three-time first-team All-American.
They have
not.
It as Patrick Ewing and Wayman Tisdale in 83, 84, 85.
Wow. Okay.
Well, because I think Norlander, you touch on, or whoever just said, you know, I saw him score 30, and I'm like, okay. Like, yeah. When people score 30, we're like, whoa, man, he got 30, right?
For him, it's just like
Shabazz Napier got 30, or Sean Kilpatrick got 30. But like when McDermott done it, it's like, so, you know, okay, whatever. When you get to the point to where you can put 30 on somebody in college basketball, and we don't really blink, like that suggests how great you are. And I wonder why it is. And listen, he's about to be a first-team All-American for the third straight year, so it's not like people are like questioning Doug McDermott. But he certainly doesn't get the – like, if Andrew Wiggins was putting up these kind of numbers, like, forget – like, he'd be leading SportsCenter every single night. How much of it is that he's not considered a top-five pro prospect compared to he's not – you know, he's playing at Creighton as opposed to North Carolina or Duke or you know, Indiana or somewhere like – like, what is it that maybe makes – Doug McDermott not be the college basketball star? I know he's a star player, but like the star, if you know what I'm saying, the difference, like Wiggins is a star and Jabari's a star and Julius Randle on some levels a star. Why do you, what is it that keeps McDermott from doing, is it because like Adam Morrison was a star?
I was just GP. Like I don't have an answer. Cause I'm just thinking, I'm like, okay, the last white dude who could put it in the, who could really fill it up. Adam Morrison
was
an absolute star. J.J. Redick
was a star.
Now, that's Duke, but Morrison was at Gonzaga, and Creighton is near that level. And like McDermott has a personality. Like, he's a really fun – he's like the only player I follow on Twitter, basically.
Yeah, no, got to remember with Morrison that year, he didn't enter the year as a star. He went out to Maui and like posted –
Michigan State, right?
Yeah, posted crazy numbers in Maui. Three straight nationally televised games over a holiday week – where he put up big numbers, and then the mustache was a big part of that. It just was. Like, it was. Like, I'm not even joking. The mustache was a big part. The hair and the – it wasn't just this dude from Gonzaga posting crazy numbers. It was the long-haired dude with the mustache.
Yeah, there was a mystique around him. Like, it was like your stoner buddy stepped on the floor and was dropping
34. McDermott needs to grow his hair out.
He's got to grow his hair out and get a mustache.
Yes.
That might be it. I don't know. It is fascinating.
That baby face is killing him.
So, no, I think in seriousness, in all seriousness, I think that not having – whatever Adam Morrison benefited from that Maui – those three straight – you know, on ESPN, Doug hasn't had that, you know, right. And I think that's why. But like the good news is that, you know, he is in the Big East this year, so there's going to be, and it's coming up soon, like he's going to get a game against Xavier and then Butler and then Villanova and then, you know, Georgetown, St. John's. I mean, he's going to play those types of teams on, you know, and then he's going to be at the Big East tournament's at the Garden again, right? So he's going to be at the Garden, you know, like I think those moments are coming for him. And I just think he's been, listen, I'm not a big proponent on kids need to stay 4 years and get their college degrees. I don't care anything about that. But I'm glad he did because it's fun to watch, you know, and particularly when I know the story's been, you know, overwritten at this point and overtold. But like there's something really cool about this mid-major recruit playing for his father and becoming quite possibly the best player in the country. And keep in mind, this isn't like a dude who was off the radar, like, well, you know, people just must have missed on. People didn't see him. He played with Harrison Barnes. Literally everybody. If you were in the business of recruiting at the highest levels of college basketball, you saw Doug McDermott. you saw him. And you just – and nobody could possibly – like, really, nobody. Nobody, including Doug McDermott, saw this coming. Like, when you talk to Doug – because, you know, I know you guys know this, but for people who aren't listening, he was originally going to go to Northern Iowa. And you know, because his dad was at Iowa State. And then Dana Altman takes the Oregon job. It opens up Creighton. And Greg McDermott takes the Creighton job. And then Doug, you know, gets his release from Northern Iowa and goes to Creighton. But when you – so the obvious question that people would ask is, well, God, if you wanted to play for your dad, why didn't you go to Iowa State? Why wouldn't you have just committed to Iowa State and played for your dad there? He didn't think he was good enough to play in the Big 12.
Yep.
Like, Doug McDermott didn't think he was a Big 12 player. So that's why he was never going to play with his dad in the Big 12, because he didn't think he belonged in the Big 12. He thought he belonged in the Missouri Valley Conference. And to see that guy who played with an All-American in Harrison Barnes and who was exposed to Roy Williams and Mike Krzyzewski and John Calipari and everybody, to see that guy having this career and this season specifically is just, again, I guess everybody's a little tired of the story at this point, but it is a hell of a story.
Agreed. And I still am fascinated by it, to be honest. I feel like maybe some people are maybe a little, I don't know, bored or just expected by it, but this is really kind of rare. Like, I was thinking about it over the weekend. Like, he's has a chance to crack 3,000 points. There's only been, what, like 17 dudes ever who have done that in college basketball. So, special guy, and inevitably we'll end up talking on the podcast about his draft position. But I'm there with you, GP. He's a first-round pick. I would take him. Take guys who can score at the NBA level. And to me, like, I know we've, like, Morrison fell flat and all that stuff, and Jimmer fell flat, but I don't know. I would still take a chance on McDermott because he's got the body for it. He's got the savvy.
He was at the USA Basketball. He was in that mini camp with Marcus Smart in the summer, and then we were out in Vegas at the time, and I went to see one of the U.S. games, and I talked to all the guys that were in that camp.
They liked him.
They loved him.
Yeah.
And they were like, he could definitely, you know, make an impact in the NBA. And like Ryan Anderson, who's probably a decent comparison,
sure,
for McDermott, he was like, yeah, he's going to have to, you know, find ways to, you know, defend inside, but like he's going to come to the NBA and make shots. And like all of them were like, you know, every team needs a shooter, and he makes shots as well as anybody. He just doesn't miss. And, you know, he'll find a way to make some sort of impact in the NBA.
I think that's true. Well, listen, we're at the 50-minute mark, so we've taken enough of your time, enough of my time, and enough of everybody's time, I presume. So let's wrap this up. I appreciate you wonderful men being here again on this Monday morning, and I appreciate all you guys listening to the podcast, reading what we write, interacting with us on Twitter. Remember, you can subscribe to the Eye on College Basketball podcast. That's on iTunes. So make sure you go and do that. It's the quickest way to make sure you get your hands on the latest podcasts. Go subscribe. And either way, I'll talk to you again a little later on this week. Take care.